Welcome to One Land, Many Voices. I'm William Seaman here with Hala Gores. Good morning, Hala.
Good morning, Will, and good morning to our listeners.
We're your hosts for this morning's program focused on Palestine, Israel, and we welcome your participation as well. If you'd like to call in with questions for our guest this morning or for us, or to just bring up an issue or make a comment, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Now, a little later this morning, we're going to be talking about a recent book that was published by an ex-president that has caused a certain controversy. We're going to talk about the slings and arrows that he's been enduring since its publication. But first, we turn once again to the crisis in Gaza. Our guest this morning is Jennifer Lowenstein. Jennifer is a visiting research fellow at Oxford's University Refugee Studies Center. She's lived and worked in Gaza City. She's lived and worked in Beirut and Jerusalem. And she's traveled extensively throughout the Middle East, where she has worked as a freelance journalist and a human rights activist. You can see her articles in Counterpunch and often on the ZNet Z Magazine website. Jennifer, welcome to KBOO and welcome to One Land, Many Voices.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be on.
Well, thank you for joining us. Let's start with your recent visit to Gaza. You were there for a brief visit in early November. What led you to this recent visit? This was a time of fairly intense Israeli attacks, some of which you experienced, I think, fairly directly. Tell us about this recent visit to Gaza.
Well, I was there because I had been sponsored by UNSCO, the United Nations Special Coordinator's Office. As you yourself know, it is very difficult to get into Gaza, and I had received a six-month clearance or sponsorship, and it was coming to an end. I had tried to get into Gaza in June and was barred because of the hostilities taking place after the Kerem Shalom attack. I was there because I am doing research on the transformation of the Palestine National Movement and the rise of the Hamas organization. And I had basically no choice of dates when I went there this last time because my sponsorship was coming to an end, and I had been disapproved or not given another six-month clearance. So I went in around October 29th, and my task was to interview a number of people in the Hamas, the Fatah, and the other factional leadership. To interview a number of people from among them, and to talk to various NGO leaders and people at the hospitals about the current situation. It was a very harrowing time and also a very deeply upsetting one because I have been to Gaza many times and I have never seen it look as bad as it did to me just a little more than a month ago.
Jennifer, this is Hala. Good morning. When did you first go to Gaza? How many years ago?
The first time I was in Gaza was in 1981. That's a long time ago now, but it was a turning point for me because I was a young Zionist at the time. I had gone overseas to Israel-Palestine as a young student on her junior year abroad. And I remember going into Gaza in 1981 and being literally shocked into silence. The second time I went into Gaza was 20 years later in 2001, and in between all of those years, I had become a very active voice, I believe, in this ongoing struggle.
How has Gaza changed between your visit in 2001 and your most recent visit?
Well, I think most people who are familiar with this situation at all know that Gaza is a desperately poor strip of land. It's about 25, 26 miles long and 4.5 miles wide. It's a tiny strip of land. It's the most densely populated area of land on the globe. And 50% of the population of Gaza is under the age of 20, which should tell a lot about the current demography there. When I first went in, it looked poor, it looked run down, it looked like a place that has been suffering. It was beginning to suffer the ravages of home demolitions, of land clearing, especially down on the Rafah border. You saw many buildings with bullet holes in them, and the beginnings of a disappearing economy. Well, I shouldn't say that. The economy had been under assault for many years, but it was becoming, I think, more visible with shuttered shops and closed storefronts all along the main streets in the poorer cities like Rafah and Khan Yunis. By the time I returned in 2002, when I stayed for a considerable amount of time, the whole area that I had first visited in Rafah, this area that had had come under attack by the Israelis in the early first few months of the Second Intifada, was gone. It was simply gone. The houses had been bulldozed. A huge swath of land had been cleared as part of a quote-unquote security zone known as the Philadelphia Corridor. More buildings were pockmarked. More had been slated for destruction. By then, probably about half of the people who were displaced from Gaza had been displaced, about 8,000 people. Now it's up to about 26,000. But by the end of the Second Intifada, it was closer to 22,000. When I went back this last time, and I had been also back in 2004, it looked like a garbage tip. It was suffering. It was gray, run down, devastated, homes and buildings bombed, disrepaired. It can't repair them. There are no funds to repair the buildings in the Gaza Strip or the streets, or the infrastructure. So, for example, during the heavy rains in the winter season, the streets flood, and there's open sewage in the refugee camps, and there's no way to repair this. There are serious electricity shortages since the bombing of the main power transformer in Gaza City last summer. There is a terrible shortage of clean water. Most people are not drinking clean water. They're drinking brackish, poisonous water that is causing major health problems. And the worst thing for me was to see that it looked like a place that had just weathered a terrible storm, like a hurricane, with trash and branches and just rubbish, detritus, all over the streets. Nothing was picked up. The civil servants, the municipal workers, have not been paid for more than 10 months. And there were piles of garbage in Gaza City that were being burned in these open garbage dumps because there was no one to clean it. Worst of all, if that isn't bad enough, worst of all was the look on people's faces, a look of total exhaustion. You know, Gazans, in my mind, are among the most resilient and most, defiant people I've ever met. I draw strength from them because of what they've gone through and of their will to continue. And yet, when I was there recently, I found people to be so tired, so despairing, and that was a very, very upsetting thing for me to see, especially in the faces of my close friends.
Jennifer, I want to turn to the interviews and the work that you were doing, if you can talk a little bit about the work you were doing studying the different political organizations in the West Bank and Gaza. But I wonder if you could also talk about the character. You were there during, I think, or shortly after, some of the worst Israeli assaults, military assaults on the region. Can you talk about the impact of that level of violence also on life in Gaza?
I think the scariest thing about that is, okay, I was there from October 29th to November 6th. The big news, the Beit Hanun massacre, happened on November 8th. But what's scary is, first of all, how many people were dying already. I remember being at friends' homes on the night of, I think it was October 31st, and we were having a very nice time. You know, Gazans, as I said, are very resilient people. We were talking, the kids were around laughing. And out of the blue, but this is typical, happens almost every night, we started hearing artillery fire in the north. Only this particular night, it was sustained, it was very loud, it was close by, meaning 10 kilometers, approximately 10, 12 kilometers away to the northeast. And, it's a war, basically, going, a one-sided war, an assault, an attack going on. And the kids who are there, you can see them tensing up again at the sounds. And yet, what's scary to me is how commonplace this has become, that people have somehow assimilated this as part of their normal routine. So I remember calling a radio station here in Madison and holding my telephone out to the sound of bombings, of the artillery fire. It went on in a sustained fashion for almost an hour and continued after that for the rest of the night. It was 2 days later that I went to the hospital, the Shifa Hospital and Kamal Adwan Hospital in the Jabalia refugee camp, and toured the wounded wards, taking photos of the victims of the Beit Hanun incursion, and also then went into the morgues. And I did that because we don't get the pictures and we don't get the stories of what's really happening there on a day-to-day basis. And it was terrifying because the pictures I took indeed did include fighters, but they also included elderly people, men and women, and most horrifying for me, I mean, as if it all isn't horrifying enough, of little children who were just literally caught playing in their yards or in the area of land in Beit Hanun and were killed just indiscriminately by fire from the Israelis.
Well, let's turn now to this whole question of the factional fighting that we're hearing so much about now. What is it that people here in this country need to understand about these different organizations? Of course, what we're seeing in the commercial media of the United States is that Hamas is a terrorist organization. The United States government refuses to talk to them. And of course, the people of the West Bank and Gaza have been living under essentially a blockade since the election, the democratic election of the Hamas government. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about these organizations and about Fatah, the histories of these organizations, so that we can better understand the situation we face today?
Well, of course, you're asking me a question that requires a lengthy answer, but I'll try to give at least some kind of an outline to it. And first of all, I want to thank you just for mentioning the international siege, because for anyone who isn't already aware, the siege that has been imposed on the Gaza Strip is partly responsible for what I'm describing, for this sense of utter suffocation, of exhaustion, because there are no food, medical supplies, fuel, all of these things are not coming in, not getting into Gaza. And as a result of that, the economy has collapsed. There is no Gazan economy. That's been very deliberate. It's a part of this attack or assault on the victory of Hamas, which won in the PLC elections last January fairly, democratic, free, transparent elections. And this siege is ongoing, and it is absolutely devastating to the people who are living there. But to the factional fighting, I think what's important to realize is that Hamas has emerged not victorious because the majority of Palestinians are going Islamic, so to speak. They're not. Palestinians are among the most secular, and I say that relatively speaking, the most secular, the most literate, the most quote-unquote westernized of all of the Arab groups in the Middle East. They are the least likely to adopt an Islamic state with Sharia law, with anything resembling what you might see in Afghanistan under the Taliban. Hamas was elected to power because people were so disillusioned and so disenchanted with what Fatah had failed to give them. It was a party that was seen as having collaborated with the Israelis and the United States. It was corrupt. It was cronyist. It was more and more removed from the daily suffering of people's lives. So in many respects, the victory of Hamas last January was more a defeat for Fatah than a victory for Hamas. People voted for Hamas as a protest vote, as a protest against Fatah. They did not vote for it, with a small exception, with a tiny percentage of about maybe 8 or 9% of the Hamas vote voted for it for ideological reasons. And that is something that I think is very important for people to understand. And it's something that's very often overlooked. So Hamas has emerged as the spearhead of legitimate resistance in Palestine. Fatah has been fractured. There are many organizations affiliated with it, but it has no single goal. It's the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, which are its militia, are not unified. And there are basically powerful people within some of the Fatah organizations, like Mohammed Dahlan, who are allied very strongly with the United States, and who I believe are basically discrediting themselves even more by accepting arms and training from the United States to fight the Hamas organization.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how it is the U.S. Assists troops loyal to Abbas?
Yeah, well, the United States, as you both know very well, lives in its own mythologically created world where it's fighting a war on terror. And this war on terror has to be targeted evenly across the region and into Southwest Asia. And any Islamic organization is included under this umbrella of terror. And so Hamas is one of those groups. It doesn't matter that the Prime Minister, Ismail Haniyeh, is a very moderate man. It doesn't matter that he opposes suicide bombings, for example. It doesn't matter that he and his circle of people had hoped to be a bridge between the moderate Islamic organizations and the more extreme ones, such as the Taliban, in reaching out to the West. These things don't matter. All that matters to the United States is that it is Islamic, and it has indeed used terror tactics in the form of the suicide bombings, which have backfired terribly and which are also indefensible, but which, you know, we have to look at things in a balanced way. The amount of terrorism used by the United States and Israel far exceeds anything that the Hamas organization has ever employed. In any case, Abbas is seen as the voice or the representative of the anti-terror forces among the Palestinians. And so the United States has been arming and funding and training personnel in Jericho, in camps, to confront the Hamas military organizations. This, I think, is going to backfire terribly, because there is no popular support for this, and people are smart enough to know that it's putting Abbas and people like Dahlan in the hands of the Americans. They're its tools. They're its collaborationist organizations. And it's only going to build support for Hamas and for other, perhaps even more extreme organizations on the ground in the occupied territories, particularly Gaza.
I want to mention that if you'd like to join us in this conversation, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. We're speaking with Jennifer Lowenstein, who is a visiting research fellow at Oxford's University Refugee Studies Center. She's lived and worked in Gaza City, Beirut, and Jerusalem. She's speaking with us this morning about a recent trip to Gaza and about her work studying the politics of the region. Jennifer, I wonder if we could talk a little bit more about Fatah, its own roots, and maybe give a little bit more nuanced picture of the politics, at least within that organization. Certainly, there is that the impression one gets looking at the events recently that Fatah suffered a major defeat in this election, and that it reflected disillusionment and the perception and perhaps the reality of corruption within that organization. But it still has tremendous support both inside the occupied territories and outside of the territories. And I'm wondering, this is a very misleading comparison, but I'm wondering if there's a degree to which you have elements of Fatah that represents, you know, not very constructive moves on the part of those people, but also elements of Fatah that reflect a very sincere and a strong commitment to liberating the territories. And
well, of course, I think that's the problem. You know, if I were a voter in the Palestinian territories, my sympathies would not be with Hamas. They would be with an organization like Fatah, which represents a much more modern, if you don't mind my using that word, or secular. It's not a secular organization, but more secular than anything Hamas represents. And certainly it's a leftist organization. It grew out of the old left. There are elements that broke away from Fatah that were even further to the left with Marxist underpinnings. I'm much closer to these organizations than to any kind of conservative right-wing Islamist organization. And I think that you have, as you said, a majority of people in and outside of the territories still voted for Fatah or Fatah-affiliated organizations. If you look at the actual tally of the votes in the PLC election from last January, what you find is that only 44% of the population voted for Hamas. So Hamas never won a majority of the vote. More than 50% of the population voted for Fatah or Fatah-affiliated parties. But because Fatah had so badly fractured and fragmented, because it could no longer represent itself as a unified organization with clear goals, with a clear vision for the future, and as an organization that could maintain its independence from the big imperial power, the United States, and from Israel, because of all of this, you had a great deal of, well, as I said, fragmentation within the party itself that drew support away from it, that caused a great deal of disillusionment among the population, and it ended up handing Hamas a victory that has been badly misunderstood here in the West. Hamas did not ever win. Hamas has never yet, including up until the time I am speaking now, commanded a majority of support by Palestinians, either inside or outside of the territories. Never. It still managed to win the elections because Fatah basically couldn't get its act together, and because so many of Fatah's leaders are indeed people who have been who have sold out and who have become very concerned only with their own privileges, their own welfare and well-being. And unfortunately, the role of the leaders very often affects the perception of the movement as a whole. That's what's happened in Palestine. And what I think is important here, however, is that the Islamic organizations like Hamas are nevertheless getting greater and greater popularity regionally. You see this up in Lebanon, for example, with Hezbollah. Everday people in countries like Jordan and Egypt that are basically allied to the United States oppose their own government and are beginning to turn to the Islamic organizations as the only ones with the wherewithal to stand up to and confront Israel and the United States. And that is a very important thing, just that in the sense of popular perception. It could have very, I think, very dangerous and devastating consequences, not because it's a bad thing. I think resistance to, you know, the imperial policies of the U.S. and Israel is a good thing, but because it's getting stronger and the U.S. policies are not giving. And so ultimately these fault lines are hardening, and it's going to end up in a very serious confrontation if we don't change our policies very soon.
Jennifer, what are the connections between Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran?
The connections are getting stronger, and first of all, what's interesting to point out is that Hezbollah has long been connected to Iran, more in the past than in the present. It was very close to the Iranian Revolution at the time of its own emergence in Lebanon in the early 1980s. It wanted to be the force for the Islamic Revolution in Lebanon. It was tied very intimately with the Ayatollahs of Tehran. But that has actually become less true in the last decade and a half, and Hezbollah is now an organization that is primarily Lebanese nationalist, even though it is an Islamic organization. It is much more concerned with Lebanon itself. But yes, it gets support and it gets funding and arms from Iran. What is really interesting is that Hamas, which is a Sunni organization, not a Shiite, Palestinians are 99% Sunnis, and the Hezbollah is about 95% Shiite. And there have been, there is a whole history of violence between Sunni and Shiite, as there was between Protestant and Catholic in the West. But what's very interesting now is that you see the Hamas leadership so disillusioned with the governments of Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, which are not supporting it, that it has turned to Tehran as a supporter. Khaled Meshaal, the leader of Hamas in exile, is in Damascus, and he's very closely tied with Syria and Iran. The Iranian government basically gave Ismail Haniyeh, the prime minister, somewhere between $30 and $35 million to take back to Gaza with him when he returned from his trip to Tehran a week and a half ago. And as some people remember, he was barred from entering the Gaza Strip as a result until he gave the funds back to someone else who could put them in Cairo in a bank. And this is all part of the international blockade. But the point here is that Iran is beginning to play a much more powerful role in Palestine. And that goes back to what I said earlier, that the configuration, that the regional configuration of alliances is deepening. The fault lines are getting clearer. You're getting Hamas, Hezbollah, you know, it's sort of a strange alliance between these two groups and Syria and Iran as the voices or the forces of anti-U.S., anti-Israel policies, while, again, something we don't understand and don't hear about here in the West is that Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, the so-called moderate Arab states, are not only allied to the United States, they are also allied to Israel and basically supported it in its war against Lebanon this summer because they are afraid of the Shiite power bloc that is developing in the Middle East.
Isn't it ironic that the U.S. policies and Israeli actions are pushing Hamas further into the arms
of these groups? Yes, that's to me the most salient point of all, is that all of this, we cannot understand the Middle East, one, without understanding Palestine. It's the heart of the issue. It's the heart of the matter, the symbol of resistance to Israel and the United States. And the very fact that, as you just said, our policies are bringing out the most extreme elements within Palestinian society, a society that is not known for its extremism, certainly not in the Islamic sense of the word. And yet, the more we pursue our policies, the more we are pushing desperate people into the arms of Hamas, of Islamic Jihad, and into the arms of the Iranians and the Syrians, who, you know, while I dislike the governments intensively, have to in some way be lauded for their willingness to stand up to the United States. Iraq has an interesting role in all of this, too, because the U.S. is courting a Shiite government there, and that has very profound implications, both in terms of Iraq itself and in terms of these fault lines that I've been describing of the Hezbollah, Hamas, Syria, Iran axis, against the Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabian, U.S. and Israeli camp.
And you're listening to One Land, Many Voices. You're tuned to KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio, 90.7 FM in Portland and in Corvallis at 100.7 FM and in the Columbia Gorge at 91.9 FM. And also available as streaming audio at our website at www.kboo.org. And we're speaking with Jennifer Lowenstein, who is recently back from Gaza. Jennifer, I wonder, there's a whole range of other topics that we should be covering, but could you maybe give us a sense of the other political groups that have formed? You've mentioned groups that have split off of Fatah. But what are the other perhaps interesting developments politically in the West Bank and Gaza?
Well, I think the most interesting of all is the fact that Palestine did, or the Palestinian Authority, because Palestine, there is no state, there were real, legitimate, fair, transparent, democratic elections. And what you see is that there are democratic institutions and democratic tendencies developing within the Palestinian territories and among Palestinians as individuals. This is important because if Hamas continues to hold power, or, you know, hypothetically, if it were to gain recognition and actually head a government of a Palestinian state, you have enough people and enough of these more secular or leftist organizations to act as a check on its power. You know, there are many people I know in Gaza who are very afraid of the Islamizing tendencies of Hamas. But one of the things Hamas had to do in order to gain a lot of its votes was to promise not to insist that all women wear veils and to promise not to insist that alcohol be banned. The sale of alcohol be banned. It had to back down on in a lot of these policies. So organizations like the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, it's been around for a long time. It's essentially, it was a Marxist organization. And but its leadership is, in many ways, the people I've spoken to within its leadership are very savvy. They know who Hamas are, who these people are. They, in some ways, have a very, you know, a civil relationship with them. The people I talked to mentioned knowing Haniya, knowing Zahar, knowing the people within the Hamas leadership, and conversing with them and talking to them in very pleasant ways. This is a positive thing, because what it shows is that you will have, unless U.S. policies and Israeli policies become significantly worse, which is always a possibility, you will have a check on the power of the Islamist organizations. That's very important. Now, one other organization that is often overlooked is the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which is to the right of Hamas. The key difference between these two organizations is that Hamas, although it is an Islamic organization, although it describes itself as fundamentally Islamic, it is even more so a nationalist movement, which is somewhat paradoxical. It's concerned with Palestine and with a Palestinian state. Islamic Jihad has subordinated the nationalist element to a pan-Islamic worldview. So it is closer to, say, the early Ayatollahs in Iran, who wanted an Islamic revolution throughout the Middle East and wanted to see Islam over the national divisions of Iranians and Syrians and Jordanians, etc. So these are all very interesting groups. I mean, we are so used to turning Palestinians into a monolithic block of terrorists, or at least Hamas into this group, that we fail to understand and to see all of the different nuances within Palestinian society, which are very interesting. There's a great deal of, I think, savoir, what do you call it? People who understand the world, they understand the way it works. One example is that we keep reading in the presses here about the impending civil war in Palestine. That is, to my mind, an example of how little we understand Palestinian society. there are no grounds for civil war in Palestine. Interfactional fighting, yes, it's gotten worse. It's being encouraged by the Israelis and by the United States. And it could get worse yet. But civil war is not going to happen in Palestine. There are no conditions for a civil war to break out. But somehow our media feeds on this image of having to show Palestinians killing Palestinians and see what they've become, you know, as if we haven't contributed in a horrific way to the desperation of an entire people.
Jennifer, you were mentioned the international blockade. Can you give our listeners an idea of what that means for Palestinian life on a daily basis, the lack of wages, how they're living, and
yes.
Go ahead.
I asked people about that. In fact, I was at Shifa Hospital, and I asked the head nurse there, who said, you know, he told me, basically, he hadn't been paid for 10 months, and I said, how do you live? And he actually looked at me as if I was questioning his sincerity, and I said, no, I'm absolutely serious. How on earth do you live? How are people getting by? And he said, first of all, on a very, interestingly, a very socialist built-in mentality that these families and extended families have to help each other out. So if you have two people employed in one extended family, those two people are spreading their resources very thin to all of the other members of the family. Another way is that they live on credit. Businessmen have no other option. You buy on credit until you can start to pay it back. How it affects people on a day-to-day basis, people in the middle class there, which is a very small percentage of the population because it is overwhelmingly poor. You have a poverty rate now close to 80%, which means that 80% of 1.4 million people are living on $2 a day or less. It's close to what one person compared to sub-Saharan Africa. This is the result of the international siege. But you have people in this middling class who no longer eat meat in their main meals, for example. It's too expensive. You have people eating dried fruits and vegetables because for a long time, especially in the summer, there was no electricity, and Gaza is stiflingly hot and humid in the summer, so there were no fans. There was no light at night. You know, you have candles or kerosene or electric lamps that you charge when you have 2 hours of electricity. But it's very hard for people here to imagine living in darkness after 5 o'clock in the evening, as it gets dark here now. You have people who don't drive their cars because there's no fuel. Suddenly you see more donkey and horse carts in the streets than ever before. I've always seen them there. But now more than ever before, you see these miserable, mangy donkeys whose ribs are sticking through their skin, pulling carts full of vegetables. And this is because there's no fuel to go around, or a severe shortage of fuel. In the hospitals, they're seeing greater epidemics, if you can use the word epidemics, of cancer. The environment in Gaza is desperate. The water people are drinking is poisonous. It's simply poisonous, and this has caused an increase in kidney disease and also in tooth decay because of the contents of the water. And one of the main shortages in the hospitals are kidney dialysis machines. So there are people dying of kidney disease who should not be dying of it. You also have a situation where the Israelis have shut down the Karni industrial crossing almost consistently for the last 10 months, so that very little is getting in terms of international humanitarian aid. And the Rafah crossing, the only crossing for human traffic, has been shut down with few exceptions. I think it's 86% of the time in the last 6 months. So it really is a human prison in that respect, and people cannot enter and exit without the permission of the Israelis. And yet, in the West, we are told that Gaza is no longer occupied. This, of course, is complete nonsense.
You mentioned the human blockade. How does that manifest itself?
It manifests itself in the fact that people can't get into Gaza. And I think Will is experiencing the difficulties right now of trying to get permission to go in, and I am one of the people who hopes very much that he does get in, because God knows people need to witness and see what's going on there. But what happens when you have a human blockade on a territory that is under siege like this is that the news reports are not getting out. As I said earlier in the program, there are pictures of terrible death and destruction and disease in Gaza that we never see. And that, as I told you, before the notorious Beit Hanun massacre on the 8th of November, there were casualties coming in every day of children and women and elderly people, not just the people who are actually standing up to fight this monstrous military. And these are not, these stories don't get into the press, because there aren't people going in to say, what on earth are we doing in this territory of land? What are we doing there? It's a terrible situation. As I left Gaza on November 6th, actually I left it the day earlier, I had been barred from entering the night before, and for a story that's a long story, but the next morning I was allowed to leave, and at 6:30 in the morning I put my bags into the taxi that had come to get me. And as I was doing that, I heard a very loud boom very close by. It's typical, it's very common, but this was very close. And I was, you know, I made note of it, and a mental note of it. And no sooner did I get in the taxi and we headed down the main street than our car stopped in traffic, and to my right was a smoldering car that had just been hit by a helicopter gunship and four dead bodies inside of it. And this was a targeted killing. Four allegedly Hamas militants were in the car. The car was an incinerated wreck. It was steaming. It looked like something out of a science fiction movie. And there were four men inside who had been blackened, burnt to a crisp, is the only way I can put it. And children had gathered, boys had gathered around this car and were picking at the wreckage. An ambulance was on its way. And this is happening in Gaza all the time. This is what people are living with, and it doesn't get reported, and no one will ever see a photo of it.
And I'd like to remind folks, if you'd like to ask a question of our guest or just participate in the discussion this morning, you can call 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187 is the call-in line here at KABU. And Jennifer, we were just handed a news story. The headline says it all: Bush signs law banning aid to Hamas government. I wonder if we could turn now to the domestic, that is here in the United States, mm-hmm. The politics around this particular issue, and maybe we could talk a little bit about something that has kind of stirred the pot, I think, in a very positive way. And that's the recent publication of Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid by Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
Hala has brought in a number of copies of this book this morning. Hala, could you tell us why is it that we have four copies on the table this morning?
What we would like to do is hear from people who would like to make a pledge to KABU. And anyone who calls to make a pledge today we'll get a free copy of Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid by Jimmy Carter.
And this is going to be on the honor system. We don't have banks of pledge takers here. This isn't a pledge drive. This is kind of an informal way for our show, for us, and I think for our listeners, to acknowledge that KABU is such a wonderful community resource. You don't hear voices like Jennifer's often enough. You certainly don't hear them in the commercial media, except in the rarest of occasions. And KABU is this wonderful community resource, and it's not free. If you've tuned into previous programs that Hala and I have done, then you know we've spoken with people in Europe, we've spoken with people in Israel and Palestine, and those phone calls alone are not cheap.
And I want to encourage listeners to please call in, because it's independent media like the kind that Will and Hala are running that really need to have support right now, especially because there are signs that there is a grassroots change in the popular mood in this country. People are starting to say, wait a minute, I'm not happy with what's happening there. I'm not sure I accept what I'm being told. So independent radio, left-wing alternative media is all the more important to allow other voices out, to let people speak, and to get a wider representation in the communities and across the nation.
So this is your opportunity to participate in the discussion, to support community media like KBOO, and, of course, to get a copy of Mr. Carter's latest book. Perhaps we could talk some more about this, the response to this book, but more generally about these signs of hope that I think you were just describing about. There does seem to be something shaking here in this country.
I think it's a very hopeful sign, and I'm not an optimist in general. So for me to say that is I think fairly serious. I notice it here in Madison even. You know, I believe that the pro-Israel lobby, which as everyone knows is far more than just the Jewish lobby, I believe that it is on the defensive, and it is becoming more and more on the defensive. Not so much on the level of politics, on the policy-making level. I don't think that it has penetrated that level yet. But one of the possible side effects of Jimmy Carter's book is that it could begin to, and that's a very good thing. But on a grassroots, popular level, there is increasing dissatisfaction with U.S. policy in Iraq, toward Palestine, and generally in the Middle East. It's not that it's a super self-conscious, bubbling over resistance movement within the United States yet. It hasn't gotten there. And there are many days when I feel frustrated at the lack of popular rebellion, I guess, towards American policy. But slowly it is becoming somewhat easier to say the kinds of things I'm saying without literally having my life threatened. And that's a good sign. I mean, as I said, I don't want to make it sound ridiculous, or at the same time, I don't want to underplay it. There are changes. You know, people reading about how Carter was invited to speak at Brandeis University, but the president of the university basically said, only if it's balanced by a debate with Alan Dershowitz will I allow that. And Carter said, nothing doing. You know, I'm not going to talk to someone who knows nothing about Palestine. I thought that was a fantastic remark. And basically, he is symptomatic of what a lot of people are saying. When universities bring somebody to speak about Israel, nobody screams about the need for balance. It's only when somebody wants to have a pro-Palestinian voice heard that the community, the pro-Israel community, gets up in arms and says, oh, we have to have balance, we have to have another side, we have to hear the other point of it. And I think people are getting sick of that. They're getting really tired of it. Here in the University of Wisconsin, for example, there is a huge demand for courses in the Middle East, for courses on the Arab-Israeli conflict, for courses in Arabic. And, of course, what are the courses most missing from the curriculum here? Those very ones that I just mentioned. There are no classes on modern Middle Eastern politics. There are no classes on modern Arab history, on the history of Arab political thought, on nationalism, on the United States foreign policy in the Middle East. You know, there's this vacuum of information, and people are demanding that vacuum be filled.
And we've got a person demanding to be heard. We've got a call right now.
Great.
Caller, you're on the line, please.
I'm not demanding. I just wonder, hello, I suppose it's not possible in this day and age because they need large amounts of money.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about the people in Palestine, Gaza, whatever, who are suffering so long and for basics and that. And for a low income, I suppose this doesn't exist because it's small, that wants to send small amounts of money once in a while to help them, but I suppose it would have to be large amounts.
No, you're absolutely wrong about that, because you have to understand, you know, $5 in Gaza goes a long way, and it makes a big difference.
But for an organization,
the best organization that I can tell you, well, I mean, there's us locally, but if you want a national organization, I would go to MECA, MECA. Just look it up on the web. It's the Middle East Children's Alliance, and it's run by Barbara Lubin. There are others. This is just the one I happen to know of that we often refer people to locally. They have people on the ground in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and they can assure that funds that you send are earmarked for specific needs, specific reasons, and that they do reach people. And it's, you know, it's true that the amount, the sheer amount of humanitarian aid that is needed right now is overwhelming. It's unimaginable. But that does not, that's not to say that $5 or $10 or slightly more as a contribution isn't going to make a big difference. It is. You know, you can go to Gaza now and live for a month on $100 because everything is so dirt cheap. For us, for Westerners, for Gazans, it just, you know, still, it makes a difference. It makes a difference between having bread and not having bread.
Well, thank you very much. Also, I want to ask something which probably won't be helpful, but I've been wondering about for a while. I guess the generations that for too many years the people in our Senate and House have been giving huge amounts of money to Israel. Does anyone know, is it possible to break or stop that energy from continuing?
Well, it's not going to happen overnight.
Yeah, well, I figured, yeah. Okay, I'll listen to you. Thank you very much, and thank you very much.
Thank you, caller.
Thanks. And voices like hers, people writing continuously to their legislators and saying, this has to stop. That will make a difference in the long run. But Americans like instant gratification. You know, we like instant results, and it's not going to be, we're not going to get instant results on this. It's a long, slow, and very often painful process.
Another organization that is doing work on the ground in Gaza is ANERA, and you can get to it through ANERA.org, Near East Refugee Aid. And you can ask ANERA to take whatever funds you donate and send it directly to Gaza for food, for blankets, to help the people. So there are organizations doing good work.
There's UNICEF, there is Médecins Sans Frontières, there's Save the Children, there are the Red Cross organizations, there's Physicians for Human Rights Israel that even has contacts in Gaza. There are a number of places to go for. You have to be somewhat careful because, you know, if you send money to any organization, you can be told that you've just supported Hamas, and that's becoming a greater and greater danger. I don't want to overemphasize it, but that's the reality here, and that's one reason why I mentioned something like Mecca, is that so far they have not been targeted as being somehow supporting directly or indirectly the Hamas organization.
Sure. Also, people are really safe to give money to Mercy Corps and to ANERA. They're U.S. organizations.
Mm-hmm.
We have one more caller, and caller, please keep it brief. We need to wrap up very quickly here.
My question was about UNICEF, but I'm wondering, are there people on the ground that are really doing the work? Because it sounds from what you've described as that's not the case.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It's harder and harder for people to get in. The key United Nations organization on the ground in Gaza is UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Works Agency. Now, even their staff, in many cases, are told that they cannot stay overnight because of the current internal, the volatility of the internal situation. So, and when you have these huge blockades on convoys of trucks bringing in humanitarian aid, you have a serious problem. But the fact is, UNRWA does exist on the ground there. They do go in every day. Some of their staff stays there permanently, and, you know, that is another way of getting aid in. So there are organizations that are helping, but unfortunately it's not enough, and
so it's better to give to UNRWA than it would be to UNICEF?
I don't think really one is better than the other. I think it's a matter of making sure that you've got an organization that can promise you, you know, if not on their website, then in person, that funds that you send will get there, that you can earmark them for specific purposes, for the hospital, for medical supplies, for food aid. I have been telling people to send money for something besides food aid, primarily because the international aid organizations, that's where they're putting their effort. So, for example, we're trying to give stipends for people in college who are living on nothing. We're trying to help a MOOC project with a medical project. We do little grassroots work here with groups in Rafah specifically because we have a sister city project there. But it's really up to you what you decide to contribute to. It's just, you know, you have to do a little bit of research on it and try to pick the organization that you think suits you best.
Jennifer, as I have listened to you for the last about hour, and thank you for staying with us so long, I am struck by how calm you are in light of everything you have observed and experienced. Can you tell us how it is that you can stay this way?
Briefly.
Yeah, briefly, I will tell you that it's necessary. I know from experience that if I get hysterical, that if I start to yell or shout or get too intense, that it backfires on me and on the cause. And I can't afford to have that happen. You have to have a thick skin in this business. You have to. And I've done this for many, many years, and I'm hopefully learning the ins and outs. Thanks.
Jennifer, thank you so much for staying with us as long as you have this morning. I will look forward to talking to you again in the future. We need to wrap up now. We have a terrific program coming up with Per Fagering. But I want to invite our listeners as well to call in future programs. We're now scheduled for the fourth Friday of each month at 9 a.m., 9 to 10. That's One Land, Many Voices. But also to write to us and make suggestions for guests. If we haven't scheduled a guest that you've suggested, it's not because we're not going to. It's because we just haven't gotten around to it. But you can write to us at pdxjustice@riseup.net. pdxjustice@riseup.net. And we invite you to participate in this program. This is community media, and we invite you to participate in this program and the other wonderful KABU programs. Hala, are there any other events taking place here locally that people need to know about?
Yes, one thing I'd like to mention is the Middle East Forums taking place at Portland State University, co-sponsored by the Middle East Studies Center at PSU and PLEA, Palestine-Lebanon Emergency Action.
And thank you again for listening. This has been One Land, Many Voices with your host, Hala Gores, and myself, Will Seaman.